I'm Kyone Wolf, and I'm here to teach you some sweet disco moves. So, for starters, let's get those legs bouncing and those heads bobbing. Yeah, that's right. Now, let's get that attitude, which is totally, I have a crappy job in a hardware store, but it's Saturday night, and once I start moving, I am disco royalty because I am beautiful when I move. That's right. Bounce, 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 bounce. And wow, Sadat just went to Israel, bob the head, and point, point, point. I think I might go see that new Star Wars movie. Point down, point up, point down, point up. Keep those legs bobbing. Hey, I might get one of those Commodore computers. Bounce, bounce, bounce. Let's unload the dishwasher. Reach down for a plate and pass it to the left. Are you ready for what's next? Let's mow the lawn. Pull the cord and push, push, pull the cord and push. How do those lawnmower blades go? Twirl the hands, that's right. Twirl the hands, that's right. Oh no, I got one of my hands caught in the lawnmower. Let's suture up that wound. In with the needle, out with the needle. In with the needle, out with the needle. In and out and in and out. Whoa, Jimmy Carter canceled the B-1 bomber program. Point and point and point. And I'm kind of getting a little out of breath, so let's just take a break and go in the back room and, you know, take some Quaaludes, which completely suspends motor coordination. Yeah. Now I'm trying to bounce and point, but I'm just sagging and pooping. Well, it's time to introduce the show, which traces disco from its roots to its current revival in the summer music scene of 2013. And now his private nurse is helping him put on his leisure suit, Colin McEnroe. Everybody dance and point and bob and sag and poop.
She actually has me bouncing and bobbing here. She's so good at that. All right, so what are we doing? As usual, I have to explain. Well, this kind of started a little bit a couple of weeks ago on The Nose when one of our panelists, Luis Figueroa, was talking about the new hit by Daft Punk, Get Lucky, and how it and a whole bunch of other songs that are popular this summer really are disco. And Luis does a certain amount of DJing, and he was just talking about how DJs have been sort of nursing disco back into the mainstream through what is called EDM, electronic dance music. Well, that got us really interesting. I just thought that all by itself was really interesting. Now, to the young staff of this show, who are much younger than I am. I mean, I sort of remember disco. I sort of take for granted that everybody remembers disco. There are pictures of me dancing semi-unironically to disco in disco clothes. I want those pictures. I want those negatives, but they do exist. So I just sort of assume everybody knows what disco is. Well, it turns out the young staff of the show is kind of saying, well, exactly what is disco and what was disco? What makes something disco? What would make something today disco in a way that would recall what disco was in the 1970s? Very good questions. We're going to try to answer as many of those as we possibly can today, those questions. Let me tell you who's with us. In a little while, you'll hear another conversation with Brendan Sullivan. We talked to Brendan Sullivan last week about something else, but Brendan is a New York DJ. He's playing in the clubs where club music is being played. He's also doing stuff like DJing for USO tours in Dubai and things like that. So has kind of an ear to the ground right now for the changes in music. We'll also talk to Eric Dan, who writes for Rolling Stone and the Wall Street Journal. That'll come later. Right now, we're going to sort of take you back to the original stirrings of disco, which I think, through the lens of history, do look a little bit different than we thought they did. And our guests will include Barry Walters. He's a contributor to Rolling Stone, E! Music, and Rhapsody, and Jamie Castor. Jamie Castor is a director and writer and producer of The Secret Disco Revolution, which comes out on DVD on September 3rd, and which I've been watching. And so we're going to start with Jamie Castor and add Barry in just a second here. If, as we go along, you have disco questions, disco memories, disco objections, or reasons why you exalt disco, any of those things, 860-275-7266. That's 860-275-7266. You may tweet us at WNPR Colin. Jamie Castor, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So let's start with just kind of a thumbnail description of the rise of disco. One of the things your documentary makes clear is that disco, although it may have come to seem to people like this incredibly slick, overproduced, and therefore highly commercial product, in a way, disco really was initially an underground movement that was so off the radar it wasn't even tracked in Billboard magazine.
That's right, yes. It's exactly as you say. It's hard to think of it now as anything other than highly commercialized form. But in fact, it began, as some of the people I talked to in the Secret Disco Revolution tell me, like early DJs Nicky Ciano and the father of the disco remix, Tom Moulton. It began as an underground club-spawned movement that was very much a kind of 60s hangover, peace and love hangover in nature, these underground loft parties. There was, in fact, what's considered the first disco club was somebody's, the loft of DJ David Mancuso. There was no entry fee, there was no booze served. I gather people found other ways to divert themselves. I can't speculate as to what those may have been. But anyway, and it very quickly, over the course of the next few years, grew bigger and bigger and more commercialized, to the point of when just a few years later, the most emblematic club, Studio 54, was in full swing and was the kind of birth of modern celebrity journalism, you might say, as well as a host of other great contributions to the culture. So that was, I mean, and it had become along the way, I should mention, a $4 billion industry. So, yes, there is a narrative, one of many of the history of disco, of this underground movement that turned into a $4 billion industry in under a decade and then famously flamed out.
You know, and it's worth also emphasizing that the people who launched disco as consumers of disco, as dancers to disco, who inhabited those clubs, a lot of them before there was a Studio 54, as you suggest, before that, these were clubs that were often repurposed factory or warehouse space down in what is now a very elegant part of New York, Soho, but at that time was a really scary freaking place nobody wanted to be. And in those clubs, what you saw often, and it's sort of even there in the footage that you can see today, is you saw gay people, black people, black gay people, Puerto Rican people. You saw a lot of different subcultures, most of them pretty marginalized at that moment, coming together. And you saw an unusually integrated social scene.
Well, as someone who grew up, you know, my personal memory of disco was as a 6-year-old dancing in my underwear to the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack for the benefit of my babysitter. So that was sort of my personal experience with it. I then grew up seeing it much as you've characterized it, you know, the kind of white polyester pants and cocaine and wretched excess and debauchery. Era of that and generic kind of watered down music, and only recently I've discovered in the course of making this film, there is a new wave. The era is being rediscovered as a potentially important time, from a social point of view, and some are even saying with revolutionary attributes that it was liberating gay people, black people, and women. These are some of the academics I talked to in my film. And I think, as you say, we see from footage that I've had the benefit of going back and tracking down for the film, that indeed people were blending, as perhaps never before, in these clubs. I think, what this means or how deliberate it was is another question. But yes, there's definitely those aspects of the era are now being investigated and appreciated and celebrated, perhaps some might say overly celebrated, but anyway.
Well, yeah, and I think what you have also is a situation where there were places that cool people could go than people who are sort of quote-unquote cool, and they were in different locations and they were more expensive. And then there were these, as is often the case, there were these other places which were highly marginalized. Geographically, they were dangerous and unappetizing. And they brought together a group of people who were, in a way that's really hard to picture here in 2013, outcasts in a lot of ways. Not insignificantly. The birth of disco and Stonewall are just walk hand in hand almost.
Well, exactly. It was illegal for I don't have the dates right in front of me, but for gay people to kind of congregate in a club and express their feelings for one another up until right around that time. So yes, they were certainly risque places in which disco and its precursors were born.
And stuff that's going to be cool usually starts out way out on the margins, where a lot of people won't go, and where people who are being treated as outcasts sometimes are willing to go. Let's add to this conversation Barry Walters, as I said, a contributor to Rolling Stone, E! Music, and Rhapsody. Hey, Barry Walters, we haven't talked that much specifically about the music. So So what was going on musically that was making disco disco? What were the original stirrings musically of disco?
Well, first of all, rock was at a time when, I mean, rock and roll was dance music, but it got to, by the Woodstock era, as something you sat down to, you took drugs to, you heard people play endless solos to. And so it was, disco started as this, as music that was taken from different areas, from soul, from funk, from danceable rock, like the off-record song by Chicago, or the Doobie Brothers, or the Jay Giles Band, and imports from Europe that kind of mirrored the soul danceable sound, and it was all those things together. There's often a debate about what was the true first disco song, but to me, disco was the combination of these kinds of records and a way to put them together in an evening. And then from there, producers thought, oh, let's take those other elements and put them all in the same record. And once they got into the same record, they became recognizable as disco.
You know, it seems to me that one of the key elements here, and it's covered in Jamie's documentary as well, is the also the transition of black music specifically into the Philadelphia sound. And the Philadelphia sound had in it some elements that really became major motifs within disco. Let's listen to MFSB. This is a song called Love Is the Message, and we'll get both of our guests to react a little bit to this. All right, so I'll go back to you for a second, Barry Walters.
Yeah.
This is maybe not exactly what disco became, but you can hear so much of what disco was going to be right in this song.
That's right. It's got the beat by I'm blanking on his name.
Was it Earl Jones?
Yes, Earl Young. It's got the strings of the area. I believe they were drawn from the symphony orchestras of Philadelphia. It's got a very talented engineer, Joe Tarsia, and that Philadelphia Records, Philadelphia International, they were really the premier black-owned record label after Motown, and the first with a contract with a major label, Columbia. So they had a great studio. They had money behind them. They had musicians who wanted to bridge the gap between black and white, but still assert a black identity.
And Jamie Castner, I think one of the things that you also hear in that song, Sound of Gamble and Huff, that Philadelphia sound, is it is sort of one of the ways that it distinguishes itself from Motown. It's almost a kind of a sense of drama to it. I mean, the strings in particular sort of give it a sense of, rather than funk and rather than just sheer beat and danceability, there's a sense that something dramatic is going on.
Well, to be contrary, I mean, it could be called dramatic or it could be called elevator. Mm. I mean, one of the ironies of disco now being celebrated as purportedly the first thing that brought races together and inadvertently or not had you know, political social effects, is that to listen to, it's hardly the edgiest black music of the era you could imagine, you know, to say the least. And its critics, even at the time, said, you know, criticized it for you know, what they term to be, you know, a whitening of soul music. Now, I don't think it's necessarily fair to blame white people for all lapses in musical taste, although many of them. You know, there's certainly, yes, we see, you could charitably call it kind of cinematic or dramatic, but you could also call it schmaltz.
All right. Well, so we have all of that, and we have a bunch of things converging. So, and I know, Barry, that you sort of say, well, maybe it doesn't make any sense to figure out what the first disco song is. But at what point do we know that it's really rolling in to its own genre? And let me even sort of sharpen that question a little bit and say, you know, one argument you could make is that it wasn't a song. It was when DJs, who had become incredibly important in this burgeoning club scene, started blending songs, started working on segues, started doing what we now think of as mixes.
Right. The technology was not quite there, but DJs figured out a way to beat match and to work via a mixer from one record to the other. And then people like Tom Moulton took that aesthetic of nonstop music, they brought it into the recording studio, and they edited together records to both extend the rhythmic passages and link songs together, like on Gloria Gaynor's Never Can Say Goodbye album,
which is a continuous one side of an album. I think the other thing, absolutely, to throw in here, perhaps, is the kind of business narrative. I mean, this is one of the things I discovered plunging back into this era. It's a fun way to look at the way that history actually gets written, because there are all sorts of versions of events that come out now. And I think in addition to the social advances and musical advances and all of that, which are absolutely part of it, there really is a business narrative that is driving what became this highly commercialized form. And the point that I think you were alluding to also in there, Colin, is that when DJs, it was the first time prior to this, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I mean that hits had generally been made by radio. And there was a cozy association between record companies and radio in, let's say, generating and profiting from hits that were made. And for the first time, this DJs and disc and what became the disco movement showed that hits could be made in a different way, in dance clubs and in records that were not selected by this cozy association, but by DJs, you know. And I think one of the things that's considered the first club hits, that a surprise club hits, is I think it was 1974. Manu Dibango's Soul Makossa.
Hey, actually, let's pause right now and play a little bit of that. All right, Jamie, pick it up from there.
Well, I think it's completely out of left field. I mean, it's a Cameroonian, soul funk sax player who comes out with a song with non-English lyrics, which is discovered by some New York DJs in apparently a record store somewhere in distant Brooklyn. Talk about, you know, Soho seeming undesirable at the time. You can imagine what that would have meant, taking your life in your hands. So they just by dint of playing it and replaying it in the clubs, people started requesting this song in record stores, and it became a hit. It became a song that you know became a hit solely out of, or let's say initially out of a DJ play. And this was the beginning of completely changing the way the music business had been working up till that time.
Yeah, and as one of your one of the people in your documentary, I think it's Thelma Houston, says, when people would hear something like that in the clubs, they'd go to the record store and they'd say they want it, and if the record store didn't have it, then they'd go to some other record store until they found it. And so you really do begin to get this kind of club and consumer-driven commercial traffic. Well, let's see what Soul Makossa turned into when it was interpreted by Kool and the Gang. This, of course, is Jungle Boogie.
Get down, get down, get down, get down, get down, get down, get down.
So Barry Walters, I don't know if this is the where people's minds first go when they hear the word disco. They may be thinking about other kinds of songs. But this song does have a lot of the elements, and it certainly became part of what was being played on the disco scene.
Right, and that was one of the records that was also a big top 40 hit. I think one of the turning points that made the industry take notice was when the Hughes Corporation, Rock the Boat and Rock Your Baby by George McRae went number one back-to-back in 1974. Shortly after that, Billboard established its own disco chart, and there was someone, Tom Moulton actually wrote the
disco column in Billboard, yeah.
Yeah. And so it became a thing where they started tracking, and then, of course, there had to be people who were trying to get the songs that were popular in the discotheques that were selling hundreds of thousands of records in New York with minimal airplay onto the radio.
You know,
and just
yeah,
to back up for 1 second, Colin, just apropos the Sol Makossa Jungle Boogie, it's an interesting kind of a little bit of conflict that exemplifies what was starting to happen. It wasn't actually – Jungle Boogie was born, according to Robert Cool Bell, who I interviewed in the film, because their record company wanted Cool and the Gang to do a cover version of Sol Makossa, because this was also a way, as these club hits started getting popular, or I think perhaps in pop music in general at that time, that you would just knock off a song on, you'd cover a song on the hit parade and at least benefit from the record sales, which whereas the real money in the music business is ultimately made by the songwriters. So as a result of knowing that, Cool and the Gang said, "Wait a second, never mind. We don't want to. We don't want to just cover this song. We'll give you our own. We'll give you our own song." So Jungle Boogie was in fact their response to the request to cover Sol Makossa. But they were anomalous. Very quickly, disco became known as a kind of a producer and a concept form in which, you know, the artists themselves were increasingly disposable. Cool and the Gang were somewhat anomalous in their ability to write songs and have some control over their career as a result.
You know, I think a lot of people are listening and thinking, people of a certain age are listening and thinking, oh, yeah, well, you know, I remember hating disco, but it wasn't really the stuff that you're playing right now. This isn't the stuff that I hated. There was another kind of thing that I hated. So at a certain point, obviously, this did become much more highly commercialized. The big players got involved. There was a certain movie that came out that celebrated not only the idea of disco, but sort of the bridge and tunnel crowd kind of discovering disco and making it part of their lives. So if we haven't alienated disco haters so far, let's play the Bee Gees, Stayin' Alive, and just sort of do the deed. All right, so something else is happening here, and Jamie, I'll sort of let you kick this off. Disco is being transformed. It still sounds a lot like what we think of as disco. I mean, you have that kind of.
I still think that's a great tune. Mm-hmm. I'm dancing around a completely non-disco environment now, even listening to that little snippet of it. I apologize, and thank God I'm alone. I think the Bee Gees and Saturday Night Fever is kind of generally considered to be the marker, the watermark of both the high point of disco and the beginning of the descent of disco as a kind of business, if nothing else. I think it was the best selling record at that time, and it was born of a kind of in a very roundabout way with a movie that was based on a New York Magazine piece, mm-hmm. Purportedly about nightlife in Brooklyn and the boroughs, but
later revealed to have been completely made up by an Irish writer who had only been in New York a couple of months at the time he got the assignment. Anyway, nevertheless, it was commissioned by Robert Stigwood, who had worked with Brian Epstein, the Beatles manager, and was then managing the Bee Gees. And so this movie was born, and is most memorable for, or has been most memorable for, this incredible soundtrack with a string of hits. I don't know, Barry, do you know offhand how many it was, 4 or 5, some kind of, you know, record that has barely ever, if ever, been matched, but certainly the best-selling record up till that time.
Yes, and those songs, I think this was one of the problems that disco encountered, was that all those songs sort of replaced each other on the top of the charts. They all had the same musicians behind them. They all had the same kind of chords and harmonies and production. And so it gave this impression that disco was all this narrow thing, and you kept on hearing it, and it got overexposed very quickly between 78 and 79.
Great point. We're going to take a break here. When we come back, we'll talk to Brendan J. Sullivan, too, about how disco has sort of been nurtured along through electronic dance music. We want to talk about the disco backlash, too. What happened? How ugly it actually got. So stay tuned. Our guests will be back. Brendan J. Sullivan will be back. If you want to hear the beginnings of electronic dance music in the disco era, here's a little Donna Summer with I Feel Love. So one of the people we wanted to talk to you about this is Brendan J. Sullivan. He's the author of Rivington Was Ours, Lady Gaga, The Lower East Side, and The Prime of Our Lives. He's also a DJ. He's been a DJ for many, many years on the Lower East Side in New York, a whole bunch of other New York venues, even with the USO in places like Dubai. So, and this is something you've been thinking about, Brendan, this whole question of kind of where disco fits into the modern music scene.
And the idea of a throwback, too, is a new idea for us, even though we always had, you know, in the 70s was Happy Days and you know, and then there was American Graffiti. But disco specifically is what we're talking about right now. Beginning in the 90s and definitely in the 2000s when this disco sound came back, and whether you call it dance music or the rave scene, or now we call it EDM, which is electronic dance music. But something like Blurred Lines just is a disco song. Now, in the 70s, there was a thing that called disposable culture. And it was just as simple as if you loved a record or a tape and you listened to it all the time, it would wear out. And so you'd have to either buy a new copy of it or get into something new. And at the same time, everything was the movie of the week. There was no internet. Your media was what's on television. And if it were a rerun, you were bummed out because you had nothing else to watch.
So are you saying that people got sick of disco and began to rebel against disco because they couldn't get away from it? Because, in fact, the dominant culture didn't really have a lot of competition from other eras. Things just kind of were central and inescapable?
They did. There were two things that made the disco backlash happen. First of all, a band like James Brown isn't disco, but it used to get in the category called rhythm. And the rhythm would just be called race music. And it literally meant music with drums. And that's what disco is. But the old ceramic records, if you put a needle on a record and it had a drum beat, if it were too loud or the bass was too groove, there was too much of a groove, it might kick the needle off the record. The record might skip. And that changed with vinyl. However, then a disco song, something with a lot of bass and a lot of drum beats, it took up too much room on a 45 RPM record. So you couldn't have that long disco dance remix. And it was in the 70s when they started pressing 12-inch vinyl that you could get a 4-minute disco song on one record. The record industry loved it because they sold tons of records with just one song on it. The backlash, though, came because even a band like the Bee Gees, there were all these like tough like Detroit rock guys. And what they saw is on their music airwaves, their only music that people were putting out was Chic and Nile Rodgers and disco. And it was predominantly a black, Latino, and gay culture that was just everywhere all of a sudden out of nowhere. And there was this whole rally in the White Sox Stadium in Chicago called the Disco Sucks Rally, where you could get in at a discount as long as you brought a disco record to burn it on the center field. And it caused a riot there because people hated disco so much. And I think if there's one thing that hasn't come back in our current culture is the dancing for it. I think that was part of the disco backlash. The original one was these rocker guys who were used to just, you know, holding up a lighter and saying how great Skynyrd was. They didn't want to do these stupid dances and wear the platform shoes and spin around and wear the white jackets. They wanted to rock, you know.
The dressing for the club, though, did come back to a certain degree.
It did, yes. It did. Now the discos are things like Electric Daisy Carnival. They're these giant – I think it's a beautiful thing because the record industry has forgot how to make stuff. They forgot how to make Beatlemania, and they forgot how to sell records. Just plastic – I mean, they're just toys, you know, for kids to buy. But what you can't sell is what's going on now. You can't package it, which is these huge festivals. They're in arenas, and it's – you walk in there – if you came to Earth from another planet, you would think this was our religion. There's a guy standing on a stage all alone, covered in lights, and he's making all the people in the room lose their minds and cheer, and it's 50, 60,000 people. And he's just a DJ playing two records. That's what kids are buying now. They're not buying the music videos and even YouTube and things like that. They're buying these $60, $70, $100 tickets to go see a guy play the record they love with thousands of people who also love that record, and they're going to just listen to it and freak out and dance with their friends and dress crazy, but they aren't doing John Travolta dances to these songs anymore.
This is all basically, I mean, you're pretty happy about this.
I couldn't be happier about it because these festivals are fun. They're all ages. I mean, people my age complain about them because, you know, some 16-year-old kid who just discovered what Daft Punk is, you know, they're furious. That goes back to what I was saying before about disposable culture. What Daft Punk really did, the thing that made them so big in the 90s, was they would take records that had been thrown away years ago. They would sample 10 or 15 seconds of it and put it into the memory of a machine they had and loop it and maybe kick up the bass or add a little drum beat to it until people are dancing to some 70s song that their parents would be embarrassed to listen to.
All right, that was Brendan J. Sullivan. I wanted to spend a little bit of time in this segment talking a little bit more about the disco backlash. And then in the final segment, Erica Danton's going to join us, talk a little bit about the way disco is now here, not only in electronic dance music, but as Brendan just suggested. I mean, it's it's right there in blurred lines. In the most popular songs of the summer, there's a disco sound. Anyway, before we do that, let me just tell you a quick story, and then I'm going to go back to Barry and Jamie for a second and talk about the backlash. So it's like, I don't know, 1981, I'm going to say, maybe 82. I'm at a party. I'm kind of DJing. I'm kind of playing some songs for people to dance to. And I've got this thing that I think is really cool, and it's Ray Charles repurposing a funked-up version of all things, Some Enchanted Evening. This isn't the version I had. This is a live version he did, I think, on television. But this will give you a general sense of the feel of it.
Some enchanted evening, you may see a stranger. You may see a stranger. Somehow you'll know.
And so I thought, this is going to be cool. I'm going to get people to dance to Some Enchanted Evening, of all things. Instead, what happened was a guy on the floor, his name is David Lieberman. He's gone on to great things as a financial writer, but he was really into music. I think he even played the bass. Screamed, "That's disco! I'm not dancing to disco!" and stormed off the floor. Now, that was all based, I think, sort of on the bass line there, on the backbeat, on that little snare that's going off the top of it. It was close enough to sounding like disco that he acted like he acted like Linda Blair in The Exorcist when they throw holy water on her. Like, I had really just befouled him in some burning, horrifying way, and he literally ran off the dance floor. That's how keen the aversion to disco had become, even among fairly cool and tolerant people. But a lot of it does track back to that night. I think it's 1979. You heard Brendan talk about the disco demolition night where, you know, they blew up all these records and people stormed on the field and so badly wrecked the baseball diamond that the second half of the doubleheader hadn't been was not able to be played. So Jamie Castor, whose movie is The Secret Disco Revolution, one of the things that really gets analyzed, and is, I think it's never really come to an angle of repose, a real area of settlement, is what was going on in the disco backlash. And what was even going on in Chicago that night? Was this a real rebellion against the music of blacks, gays, Puerto Ricans, you know, by sort of a white ruling class that wasn't happy about that? Or did people just not like the music?
Well, again, this is part of the let's say, fun challenge of looking at how history gets written this long after the fact. And thankfully, in this case of history, it's, you know, disco and not war we're talking about, and there's still enough of the original players around to talk to it. Some of the kind of revisionist historians I talked to in the movie, Alice Eccles, for instance, a prof in California, sees this as clear evidence of, as Brendan was saying, you know, the backlash of racism, sexism, and homophobia against this incredibly liberating disco music and culture. Now, to accept that fully, I suppose you have to fully accept that that's what was disco's purpose in the first place, which I debate. I don't debate that those elements were there, but if it was a revolution, it seems to me it was certainly more of an incidental one, that this was more of a party. It was more of a party time, and if people blended as never before, rather than seeing this as the revolution per se, I would suggest that maybe it was the after party suggesting the enjoying the advances that had been achieved by more traditional revolutions like the civil rights movement and Stonewall, etc. But anyway, business or disco, as we talked about, had very quickly gone from an underground club phenomenon to something that turned the music business on its ear and became a $4 billion industry in the matter of a few years. And I think that looking at the business narrative of events, we're looking at, as Brendan was talking about, there's the kind of Lynyrd Skynyrd fans with the lighters at the concerts, and there is also their representatives in the music business who had enjoyed very much, you know, what was called the payola system between record companies and radio DJs that had worked perfectly well for them for a long time leading up to when disco upset this with its club-generated hits. And concurrently with what we were talking about with Barry about disco having gone from something organic to something more producer-driven, you know, as another Larry, whose name, Larry Harris of Casablanca Records, the biggest disco label at the time, puts it in The Secret Disco Revolution. He says, you know, disco had become a producer and a concept, a generic cookie cutter, you know, hit after hit with, as Barry said, the same backing musicians generating an interchangeable, disposable bunch of singers. It had reached, it had oversaturated the market with this generic stuff, and at the same time there was the whole rock radio record industry that was unhappy at having been lost its supreme sway over the business. Now, I mean, this event in Chicago, we're talking about Disco Demolition Night in Comiskey Park in Chicago, in which a disgruntled radio DJ, I hope you never, you know, if things don't work out, Colin, you don't turn to this kind of action.
It's too late for that. Anyway.
And Call, who had lost his job at a radio station, a formerly rock radio station that had turned disco, I'm talking about Steve Dahl, then orchestrated this in conjunction with the park owners, you know, this publicity event called Disco Demolition Night.
Which I've seen described and defined so many ways. One historian even talked about it as the final fragmenting of the New Deal coalition.
Describe it somewhat ridiculously.
Oops, sorry, I didn't mean to put you on hold there for a second, Jamie Kastner. But, yeah, people talking about working class whites walking away from people who had been part of a New Deal coalition. Once again, some of those marginalized minorities. I didn't mean to put Pop Jamie on hold, but since I have, we do need to take a break here, or we're not going to get to the influence of disco on modern music. So I think Jamie and Barry would both agree this is one of the death knells of disco, Ethel Merman's disco CD or LP. We'll be right back.
and bounce and bounce and point, point, point. Patty Hearst is guilty? No way, no way. Shake your head to the left, to the right, to the left, to the right. You're innocent, Patty. Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me. The part of Bill Curry was played by Sister Sledge. On tomorrow's show, in a world of voiceover artists, what's it like to be a voiceover artist? And now, back to Colin and Point and Bob. Dorothy Hamill, Just One Gold and Point and Twirl.
Oh, I wish I could play more of that. But it sort of worked out nicely. It segued nicely from that semi-horrible, I think that's Michel Legrand or somebody doing an instrumental disco thing that Wolfie's been talking over before the whole show, into the latest hit by Daft Punk. And actually, there are a few little musical commonalities there. Now, Eric Danton joins us. He writes for Rolling Stone and the Wall Street Journal. I mean, to me, this Daft Punk song, Eric, is unmistakably a disco song.
Yeah, it very much is, and they would not pretend otherwise. The whole record really is a throwback to disco. In addition to Nile Rodgers playing guitar on a bunch of it, there's a long spoken word thing from Giorgio Moroder, who's an influential disco producer who had a lot to do with some of Donna Summer's hits.
And so is it the case that disco has sort of been, and you, certainly you could, you heard Brendan say it before, that Blurred Lines is a disco song. We played a little snippet of Justin Timberlake's Take Back the Night, which to me also is a disco song. Is it a sudden volcano that just erupted, or has been disco been kind of a dormant virus lying inside electronic dance music for a really long time?
It hasn't always been dormant, I don't think. You know, disco now is part of pop music, and as such, like various other parts of pop music, I think it ebbs and flows. There's a lot of it this summer between Timberlake and Daft Punk and Robin Thicke, but, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, the band Scissor Sisters did a great disco version of Comfortably Numb. It's popped up here and there ever since it was first popular.
Actually, let's just talk about the Scissor Sisters for a second, or not talk about them, but listen to them. We've got Scissor Sisters. This particular song is Lights. All right, we're talking to Eric Danton. So, you know, I think maybe one difference between now and then, and I was alive and a semi-adult for disco didn't have much of a sense of humor. You know, it didn't have much of a sense of humor about itself or about anything else, with some notable exceptions. I think Nile Rodgers and Chic, that they sort of got a joke, and certainly the act that turned into Kid Creole and the Coconuts got a joke. I think they were Dr. Buzzard's original Savannah band. But, you know, today it seems to me you have to have a little bit of an archness or a wryness or something to you to get that over.
There's definitely a lot of irony about it now. I mean, Scissor Sisters, they play the song straight, but there's definitely some irony in how they do it. Some of the disco resurgence that we're seeing now is in part a result of, you know, the cool kids, the hipsters, embracing it in a way and bringing it back to the forefront culturally.
And I think it also, I mean, not insignificantly, we did have Brendan Sullivan on a little while ago. And the other thing that happened was clubbing got really big again. And if you're going to be, in a club, not listening to live music, you're going to be listening to a DJ who's mixing, matching, spinning. I mean, it kind of lends itself to what disco was in the first place.
Yeah, it's dance music, and it always has been. You know, if you're not listening to a live band, you're not going to go to a club to hear a DJ spin Elliott Smith songs. You know, you're going to go so you can move and have a good time and dance and meet people and hook up and do all the things that disco was known for back in the day and still is. You know, EDM, electronic dance music, as Brendan said earlier, is the latest incarnation, and it's doing the things that disco did. It's just evolved some sound-wise until bands like Daft Punk took it back because, they seemed like they were bored with where EDM was going, so they figured they would do roots EDM.
And I guess the other part of this is, and I should have even thought of that as we started to plan this show, and I realized that, the rest of the people who work on this show, Kyone and Patrick, all these and our interns, they don't have any latent prejudice. They don't want to gouge their eardrums with barbecue skewers the minute they hear disco. And maybe that's another part of it, that the consumer generation that came along here, I mean, there was this weird almost taboo, fetishistic rejection of disco that it just was way all out of proportion to the music itself. And there's a whole bunch of people around who don't even remember that.
Yeah, these days, people who were not alive to hate disco the first time around are much more ecumenical about it. It's like the white kids at the Pitchfork Music Festival really getting into R. Kelly's set. There aren't the same sort of genre divisions that there would have been even 10 years ago, because now it's just music, and you can like the music or not like the music, but you will not necessarily be predisposed to hating it just because it is a certain thing.
And things fuse together, too. Like, when I first heard Justin Timberlake's new song, Take Back the Night, to me it does sound exactly like a disco sound with a certain amount of Quincy Jones, kind of Michael Jackson-type overlay to it, but still basically a disco song. Then I watched the video, and he's basically crip-walking, and I thought, well, so it's not really a disco song because he's not really doing anything that resembles disco dancing. And I guess that's another part of it, is that these days everything is kind of fused together. It isn't just one overwhelmingly obnoxious dance and fashion drenched musical form.
Right. It's not John Travolta pointing on the light up dance floor of Saturday Night Fever anymore. It's part of a bigger whole that encompasses rock and roll. It encompasses punk rock. I mean, the band Chick Chick Chick, the one with three exclamation points for a name, they have a lot of punk influences and a lot of electronic influences, but there's definitely disco in there too. And it's just taking all those things and blending them together and reflecting them back at listeners.
All right. Well, listen, Eric Danton, great to talk to you about this, and thanks to all of our other great guests, Brendan Sullivan, Jamie Kastner, Barry Walters. Jamie's movie is The Secret Disco Revolution. Check it out. It's coming out on DVD. And I don't know what else to say. I'm interested to hear what music we're going out on, though.
I'm Kyone Wolf, and bend back. Okay, too old. Patrick, can you get me my Quaaludes?